Original Gangsters News with Scott Bernstein.
Welcome to the Original Gangsters News Network and podcast. We're going to do a GOAT episode, the greatest of all time, the Mount Rushmore of American La Cosa Nostra, the top 10 U.S. mafia dons of all time. We're going to break it down. And before I start, and I'm gonna go 10. I'm start at 10 and lead up to the number one mob boss in history in La Cosa Nostra, according to yours truly and our Original Gangsters brand. So I'm excited about this. It took a lot of time in the war room, doing a lot of cost-benefit analysis or, you know, pluses and minuses of why certain guys should be on or where they should be. Had to leave a couple guys off that I was hesitant to do, but convinced myself why. And I'll explain that all as I lay this all out. But you get, you know, points for being one of the founding fathers. You get points deducted if you were somebody that lost the reins of your crime family later in your tenure. We had to, you know, get outside of New York City for this. So this is taken into account, you know, all 26 original La Cosa Nostra crime families. We could do just a New York City list. We could do just a Chicago list and just, you know, just Philadelphia. And I think we're going to do that, New England. But this is the definitive top 10 United States La Cosa Nostra bosses. And we're not talking about under bosses or consigliers or acting bosses. This is a boss ranking. And this is going to be, you know, the Mount Rushmore for OG Pod when it comes to, you know, this how this stacks up in 2026. I know I did a similar podcast. It had to have been like 4 or 5 years ago with some other content creators where we all kind of chimed in with our top 10s. I don't remember exactly how my top 10 was formatted back then, so I don't have anything to compare it to. But right now, this is where I stand, where the OG brand stands with ranking the best U.S. mafia godfather. So let's start at number 10. And this is a guy, you know, all these guys, especially in the back five, could easily be in the front five. This is, you know, this is all rarefied air. So number 10, Tommy Three Finger Lucchese. Now, Lucchese was a game changer, but he was only officially a Don for about 16 years. So that's why he kind of dropped to the back five. But make no mistake, Tommy Lucchese was very transformational and was somebody that really took the mafia, organized crime, La Cosa Nostra into the post-World War II era and helped shape it and mold it and find new pockets in terms of rackets, new spaces to exploit, and became super rich and super powerful. I think probably his crowning achievement was the way that he took over and dominated and really innovated the garment district rackets, trucking and trash rackets. He was somebody that left a very big imprint. And, you know, his legacy is that the name of the organization is still the Lucchese crime family, for somebody that was in power for about a decade and a half. Now, he had been, you know, on a street boss, underboss, acting boss for a couple decades before he took the top spot and was there from the beginning. So that counts for something, but he still comes in at number 10 in our list. All right, let's go on to number 9. And we got Joe Bonanno coming in the 9th spot. And this is, again, you know, he was a founding father of La Cosa Nostra, so he could easily be, you know, higher on this list. But I bumped him back into the back 5 because he lost control of his crime family, was deposed, and had to live his final 35 years or so in exile in Arizona. You know, you could potentially argue that, you know, from exile, he still might have had some say in some things, or at least was consulted on some things. I think that they checked with him before they whacked out Carmine Galante. But for all intents and purposes, he was stripped of any authority in the late 60s. And yeah, he went down to Arizona and kind of did his own thing down there and pioneered some of the Cosa Nostra activity in, you know, the Wild West, in the Southwest. But, you know, unfortunately, the back end of his life and the fact that he wrote a book, which was really shattering Omerta, and it was 10 years before Sammy the Bull and Crazy Phil Leonetti you know, kind of broke the seal on all of the informants and whatnot. That, you know, Joe Bonanno went on 60 Minutes and wrote a book in the early 80s, and that really had ripple effects that we're still feeling today, honestly. So that's why he gets the number 9 spot and isn't higher, but he was a founding father, and the name of the crime family today still bears his name. So, you know, his legacy is in the fact that there's still a Bonanno crime family. I know that Joe Messina at one point tried to change the name because of what, you know, what Bonanno had done and breaking the oath and getting kicked off the throne. And for a while, he was telling people that it was the Messina crime family. That never really stuck. And it's still the Bonanno crime family today. But that's where we are with our first two. Let's go to number 8. And number 8 is Stefano Magadino, the Undertaker. Don Stefano, you know, one of the founding fathers, again, had a huge empire that stretched over multiple states and countries, was somebody that helped create the blueprint for what La Cosa Nostra is, somebody that had power before the formation of LCN, and then was a ruler of some sort for, you know, 40, 50 years. And just like Joe Bonanno, for him, unfortunately, you know, the legacy is a little bit tainted because he lost the respect of his troops and was pretty much forced into retirement when his rank and file, the people that made up the Magadino crime family, learned that he had been lying to them and hoarding rackets and not giving people proper compensation for things and playing dumb with certain narratives, and just really lost, you know, lost the hearts and minds that you need to gain in order to take over a crime family or found a crime family. So Don Stefano, even though his power was immense, and in terms of overall power, in at the peak of his reign, he could easily be in the top 5 because his reach was so long. I mean, he had the Western New York. He had into big parts of Ontario, Canada. He was tied into drug rackets in multiple, you know, international destinations. So he is definitely somebody that, you know, and the crime family today in Buffalo maintains the Magadino moniker. So that's a big part of his legacy. But because in the last, at least the last 5 years, last 5 to 10 years of his life, he was on the outs with the organization that he had founded. So that's why he bumps back into the top. That's why he bumps back into the bottom five of the top 10. So let's go to number seven. And somebody that when you're talking pound for pound power was just a supernova or a juggernaut and could easily be higher on this list. And that's Carlos Marcelo, the Kingfish, the quintessential Southern mafia don from New Orleans, and somebody whose power was an influence was, you know, transcontinental. A guy that, you know, had the power to elect a president and kill a president. Somebody who served in a boss capacity for 40 years, roughly. And somebody who, you know, when the mafia was in its golden era, when it was, the mafia itself was at its apex of power and influence, Carlo Marcello was right up there with all the top dons in New York City. He was a master chess player when it came to all the different rackets and how to protect and insulate yourself in those rackets with political corruption and layers of insulation and doing business with multiple groups, both in the United States and out. A guy that really helped spread La Cosa Nostra around the southern part of the United States. I mean, not in the sense that, you know, the New Orleans is the first mafia family, really. I mean, before the New York Five families were established. But and Marcelo was not a founding member of La Cosa Nostra. He took power in the late 40s. But it's night and day when you're talking about what was going on in that part of the country when Marcelo took over and before he took over. He grew that empire to epic heights, meteoric heights, and had respect around the globe. And somebody who did things very quietly and, you know, wasn't known as someone necessarily that courted the headlines or courted the media. Somebody who had a reputation that was both of a statesman, a diplomat, a businessman, but also a tough as nails gangster. So let's move on to number six. And going to my hometown of Detroit, probably the most underrated mafia don in American history, Giuseppe Zirilli, a.k.a. Joe Uno, Joe Pepino, Don Giuseppe. This was the prototype, you know, the quintessential mafia diplomat, statesman, somebody that was so respected outside of his hometown of Detroit, which he led through a half century of peace and prosperity after winning the Crosstown Mob War in 1931 with him and his brother-in-law, Black Bill Toko, and created Detroit's La Cosa Nostra. Worked very closely with Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Joe Profaci, and it was not just respected enough to be named as a member of the commission, but was the, you know, de facto consigliere of the commission. So when the mafia dons that ruled the country needed counsel, they went to Joe Zirilli. When they needed disputes settled between different families and organizations that dealt with the commission, they sent Joe Zirilli. A man of few words and a man of a pretty small stature, but who did everything the right way. He pioneered so many game-changing La Cosa Nostra, not necessarily rules, but he could have wrote a book about how to operate, expand, and dominate with a criminal organization, and doing it as much in the shadows as you can, doing it with the proverbial velvet glove while not being afraid to let loose the iron fist. So, you know, Joe Zirilli was somebody that might have been the quintessential diplomat, but he pushed a lot of buttons. I mean, you're talking about a lot of guys that, you know, didn't come home the next night or live to see another day because they crossed the Toko Zirilli crime family. And this is something that was able to sustain the Detroit family without putting anybody in prison, without having any cooperators. He innovated the, you know, taking the second generation of a crime family and making sure that they're educated. All of the second generation sons, nephews, and grandsons had to go to college and get into the boardroom. And this was in the 40s and 50s. This was way before people were thinking like this in other parts of the country later on. He made sure that everybody was diversified. He made sure that there were buffers in place. He was a guy that truly knew how to blend racketeering and gangsterism, put them together, and journey to, you know, places in the criminal underworld most could only dream of. Because Joe Zirilli was just like we were talking about some of these other bosses, he was transcontinental and controlled pretty much all of the his organization. Vis-a-vis, you know, him, vis-a-vis his organization, controlled almost all the heroin that was coming into this country in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Was somebody that never lost his grip on the Detroit family to the day he died, from when he took power in the 30s until he died peacefully, surrounded by loved ones, very wealthy, and having never really done a more than a night in jail his whole life. Had been on the throne for over 40 years. His family was, again, the definition of stability, functionality, and is somebody that doesn't get enough credit, frankly, because, you know, people think of the mafia, they think of New York, they think of Chicago, they don't really think about Detroit. But Detroit was really the wheel that everything spun around in regards to interstate commerce, you know, Teamster Union, political, police, corruption, the ability to shut down the country with one phone call. And this was a man that was about 5'4", 140 pounds, and was arguably as powerful as any of the New York bosses. So just obviously I'm biased. I'm from Detroit. And he was going to be on this list, but he deserves to be on this list. And he's not in the top five, but I think you could make an argument that he should be in the top five. But I got him at number six, and let's move on to our top five. Number five, the Olive Oil King, Joe Profaci, really the archetype for what a mafia don was, or how it was, you know, at least viewed by the American public. Immortalized in the character of Vito Corleone in the Godfather book and movie. Joe Profaci was the basis of that character. And Joe Profaci was one of the founding fathers of La Cosa Nostra. His business legacy exists today. The Olive Oil King, you know, the family of the Profaci family is still some of the biggest olive oil distributors in the world. I think they're definitely or most likely still the biggest distributors in the United States through their ownerships of the different parts of that industry. And again, they pioneered it. when I'm talking about how these guys stack up, though, and I've mentioned this when I started, and I've hit two other bosses in terms of downgrades for this, you know, Joe Profaci doesn't get into the top two or three because he lost control of his crime family at the end. And we don't know what would have happened if he wouldn't have died of cancer in the early 60s, but it was at a time when his 30 years on the throne was being challenged, and the family was in an upheaval with the Gallo brothers and Crazy Joe Gallo coming at him. It didn't stop when he died. You know, there was war and dysfunctionality for until a decade after he was gone. So, you know, that works against him. But again, he was the archetype for what a boss was. And this was a guy that, in terms of money, power, influence, reach, I mean, he got audiences with the Pope. The Pope was considering making the guy they wanted the saint to give him sainthood. He gave so much money to the church and was somebody that was, you know, the epitome of a leader of the community in Brooklyn, as well as a mafia don, and helped a lot of people out, and was somebody that was a founding father of La Cosa Nostra, and, you know, definitely is, you know, should be in the top five in our opinion. So let's go to number four, the Chin, Vincent Giganti, and the West Side, Genovese crime family. They're the Cadillac of the mafia, the Ivy League. The Chin really took a page out of Tony Accardo's book, and we'll get to him momentarily, and brought it to New York City and implemented it, and was really the master chess player when it came to this, which is, you know, being the guy behind the guy behind the guy. And Vincent Giganti might have only come into the headlines and media coverage later in his reign with the whole, you know, Odd Father act and pretending that he was crazy. And there was some brilliance in that, mind you. But he had been the power behind the power in that organization since Vito Genovese had passed. He was Vito's protege and, you know, really stayed in the shadows through a series of front bosses and acting bosses for most of his career as a Don, and really committed to the whole, you're not going to see me out at clubs, you're not going to see me out acting normal. By the 80s, he was doing the cuckoo act and walking around Greenwich Village in his bathrobe, talking to trees and light poles. And it was all an act. He admitted it was all an act, but it worked, and it worked for about 20 years and kept him out of prison. When people started to get hip to the fact that he was the guy behind Tony Salerno. He was the guy behind Fonzie Thierry. He was the guy behind Benny Squint. So he, just that type of ingenuity, gets you into the top five. And then he really was a La Cosa Nostra. He was somebody that believed in that oath at a cellular level and believed in living your life by a set of rules, parameters, being disciplined. He was somebody that knew how to make a lot of money, knew how to exert influence without having to be seen or heard. Somebody that mentored all of the people that have continued on the legacy of the Genovese and the West Side and have continued to make it the number one crime family in America, and the best of the best, the elite, all these people are people that learn from the Chin, the way the Chin learn from Vito Genovese. So the Chin is, he's on Mount Rushmore. He's at number four. And, you know, one of the final things I'll say about him is that I think the whole crazy like a fox thing worked against him from a public perception, because it made it was a little bit of a, you know, carnival act, even though there was a method behind the madness. He didn't, at least with the public, didn't have the esteem of a Don Carlo or a Joe Profaci, you know, guys like that. And he did. You just didn't see it. You know, you didn't see him with a three-piece suit and swaggering into clubs and restaurants and preening for the camera, whether it be like a John Gotti or just simply coming in out of court. He committed to the crazy act, and he didn't care if the public thought he was a Looney Tune and if it affected the way the public viewed him against someone like Gotti. Because in, you know, when you're at the end of the day, John Gotti's not even close to the top 10. And I love two kind of anecdotes about the Chin. And I know I've told him before, but I'll just reiterate it. One of the reasons I put him in the top five was, first, when he meets with John Gotti, and John Gotti says, you know, I'm so proud. I made my son last night. I inducted him. And he's going to be one of us now. And the Chin, he was expecting the Chin to congratulate him and be happy. And the Chin was like, that's horrible news. That's, why would you want to bring your son into this? So that type of self-awareness, I acknowledge and appreciate. And then the entire, we don't demote our captains, we kill our captains. And that's like, that's believing in the oath. That's believing in the code. That's believing in for a penny, in for a pound. There's no wiggle room. There's no half in, half out. If you get a promotion to a skipper and you're not up to the task, we're turning your lights out. We're not putting you on the shelf. We're not demoting you so you could, you know, go live off and live on a beach in Florida. You know, we're putting two in the back of your head because you didn't do the job. And, you know, I don't condone murder or being a mobster, but that type of accountability is what has made the Genovese crime family, the New York Yankees, the LA Lakers, the Dallas Cowboys, the New England Patriots when Tom Brady was there, you know, you know, the perfect crime family. So let's move on. Let's go to number three. And number three is Don Carlo. Carlo Gambino, you know, they called Angelo Bruno the quiet Don, but I think Carlo Gambino was the quiet Don. Angelo was somebody that a lot of the reputation, a lot of the lore about Angelo Bruno, this isn't true. He really wasn't a docile Don. he was a pretty greedy Don. So, and he lost control of his crime family. Lost the faith was broken between him and his men. But Don Carlo was the quiet Don, in that he didn't have to raise his voice. He didn't even have to really talk. You know, a nod of the head or a shrug of the shoulders or a gesture with his hands could move mountains. And he took the Gambinos, or he took the crime family, named it the Gambinos, now carries his name and his legacy. But he made that crime family elite. The Genovese and the Gambinos are really at a level all their own. And then the other three crime families come in after that. And a lot of that has to do with what Don Carlo did, what the Chin did, and that foreshadowing or those seeds that were planted, the foundation that was laid paying dividends now in the 2020s is why they're on so high up on this list. And Carlo Gambino was everything you would want in a godfather, checked every single box. I guess the only thing going against him, and he still made the top five, he made the top three, but his decision to give the family to his brother-in-law, Paul Castellano, was probably a little misguided. Probably should have gone to Neil De La Croce, and things might have been a lot different in terms of where that family went in the 80s and early 90s. They survived it, though. The Gotti-Gravano thing, it didn't sink that crime family. They got actually stronger after that whole situation and use it as lessons learned, and took what was a really negative scenario and era, at least the end of the Gotti era, into the 90s with the trials and everything. They learned from their mistakes and leveraged it forward. And like I said, the Gambinos and Genovese are on a plane all alone in a category all by themselves. So, Don Carlo, just, game changer again. That's what this is what this list is about. Guys that, were disruptors, guys that made La Cosa Nostra what it is and what it's about. And people have been writing the obituary for the mafia in America for decades now. And it's pretty durable. It's pretty resilient. And it's because of the foundational infrastructure that guys like this either created themselves or built upon after it was created them. So Don Carlo comes in easily at number three. Now, the top two spots I had a real debate about, and I moved it around a couple times, but this is where I'm at right now. And I'm pretty confident. So number two, Lucky Luciano. He was the architect of La Cosa Nostra. This was his brainchild. He was a brilliant mafioso, somebody that had vision and the ability to not just conceive something, but to go out and sell it. And there would be no American mafia the way we see it now, the way it is now, if it wasn't for Lucky and Meyer. And so Lucky Luciano was so foundational, so revolutionary, transformational, that he has to be in the top part of this list. Now, if he was one, two, or three, I got him at two. Got exiled by the government, the U.S. government, even though he was working with the government, not in snitching, but in terms of World War II and helping the Allies win the war and getting rewarded for that, in that he was allowed to go live off in Italy for the rest of his life. And he was still exerting influence over there. And he was somebody that everybody looked to as the godfather's godfather. He was the chairman of the board until the day he passed, even when he had been out of the country for over a decade. So Lucky Luciano could easily be number one, but I got him at number two. Number one on this list, the Big Tuna, Joe Batters, Tony Accardo, the boss of the Chicago outfit, the man behind the man behind the man. He you know, what I said about the chin, you know, the chin learned this from Accardo, or I mean, not directly, but Tony Accardo was the GOAT, is the GOAT of all the GOATs, and had full power in Chicago from the 40s until he passed away peacefully, surrounded by family and friends, super, super wealthy, having not done a night in prison or jail in 1992. A guy that modernized organized crime in Chicago after the Capone and Nitti era. Somebody that was just as powerful as any mafia don in New York. Somebody that could go anywhere in the world and find respect as a crime lord. He was a man just like Carlo Gambino, a man of few words, didn't need to talk much to get his point across. He didn't court the spotlight. He loved being in the background, the Wizard of Oz, as many buffers, as many front bosses as possible. But everybody knew, everybody that really knew what was going on. Sam Giancana could go around pretending like he's Al Capone 2.0 throughout the whole 60s with the Rat Pack and 50s and 60s with all the Maguire sisters and running around with JFK and all that shit. He was playing boss. I mean, he was a very powerful guy, but Tony Accardo was the boss then with Joey Iuppa for all those years. Tony Accardo was the boss. Even when Iuppa and Jackie Strong went away and Joe Ferriola and then Sam Carlisi, Tony Accardo was the boss. So he really flipped the script on everybody, reinvented the way the game was played, and then just played the government like a fiddle. They could never bust this guy. They tried so many different times. He really invented how to insulate yourself to the point when the RICO Act was finally put into play and written and weaponized. He had been preparing for that moment for 30 years. And that's the brilliance in Tony Accardo. 50 years in power, never challenged. Doors open for him wherever he went. Respect, you know, the what I call the trifecta. Somebody that's loved, feared, and respected. And he hits every single one of those, hits a grand slam with it. And that's why Tony Accardo is the number one United States mafia boss of all time, according to the original Gangsters News Network and podcast. This is our top 10. I'll just, as I close out, you know, Vito Genovese could have easily been on this list. I didn't really, even though the organization holds his name still, I don't know how good of a boss he was, honestly. He kind of tried to do what Lucky had done with the drugs and wasn't as successful. His reign really wasn't that long. I think it was about 15 years. And maybe I should have had both him and Tommy Lucchese on this list, but it was kind of like I was going to do one or the other, and Lucchese won out, and Vito Genovese doesn't make the top 10. You know, if this was like the NCAA basketball selection show, it would be controversial, and there'd be people, if there were analysts, you know, arguing that he should be top 10, but he didn't make the list. Another person that was a late scratch was Raymond Patriarca. The prototype Don in New England. But, Raymond made a lot of money, had a lot of power, and power, not just in New England, in New York, across the country, out to the West Coast. But, you know, what happened with Bonded Vault, takes points away from him for me. He stole from his own crime family, stole from his own soldiers, which is never a good look. And even though he wasn't there for when things started to crumble in the years after he died, he didn't prepare his son for the job as boss. And Junior Patriarca took the role and didn't do a very good job. Fumbled the proverbial bag, and I gotta unfortunately deduct points for the old man for that. So, Original Gangsters News Network and podcast. I hope you enjoyed this top 10 ranking. And please like, share, and subscribe. Original Gangsters News Network. We're here uncovering the underworld 365, 24/7. Anything that's going on in the North American underworld, we're hitting it. Breaking news, analysis, insight. You're not going to get any better than here at OG. So check it out. Whenever you can, go to our web magazine, The Gangster Report. Go over to our Patreon, members only. We'll be there giving you your true crime fix. For Benny, my producer, I'm Scott Bernstein, Original Gangsters News Network, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. I'm out.